This is Greater LA, KCRW's show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiotakis.
¿Qué milagro? ¿Frijoles?
No.
It's turkey.
Today, we're going to the Coachella Valley to a Catholic church called Our Lady of Soledad. It is lunchtime. Folks are hungry. About two dozen people here are sitting patiently as volunteers make up plates of chicken salad tostadas, stewed turkey, and pasta with marinara sauce. For most of the folks at this table, this is the first real meal that they've had in days.
Yo me sentía débil porque cuatro días sin comer, porque lo que conseguía era para mi niña. Pero ya al llegar acá, pues ya hemos recobrado fuerza.
Otra vez, cuatro días no come nada.
Cuatro días.
¿En serio?
Sí. Porque yo traía un poquito de dinero, le venía comprando cositas a ella, yo solo traguitos de agua, así.
So for 4 days you didn't eat and you had a little bit of money, but what he's saying is he bought food for his daughter, por su hija.
Sí.
That's Alberto Chabe speaking with KCRW's Benjamin Gottlieb. Chabe and his daughter, Isabel, are seeking asylum in the United States. Their journey began in El Salvador.
Muy crítico todo. No hay trabajo.
Chabe says it's hard to find work in his home country, so young people turn to gangs. He refused to join a gang, and so a few weeks ago they left their small town on a bus, and they've made it this far, 95 miles north of the U.S.-Mexico border, north of the border. But their trip is far from over. More than 2,500 miles separate them from their final destination in Manassas, Virginia, which is right outside of Washington, D.C. That's where his brother-in-law lives, and their best chance of getting there is this church.
One of the blessings I have is I'm probably one of the first gringo faces they get to see that smiles and tells them welcome, because that's not been their impression of coming into the United States.
That's Father Guy Wilson. He's the pastor at Our Lady of Soledad. His church, over the past 6 months, has basically become a de facto migrant processing center. As the border has become flooded with migrants like Chabe, the federal government's Customs and Border Protection has essentially outsourced some of their work to places like this one. Here with more now is KCRW's Benjamin Gottlieb. Hi, Benjamin.
Hello, Steve.
So what is going on at this church?
So you've probably heard of people fleeing gangs and violence before from their home countries and coming here to the United States. But what happens to them after they cross? Well, this church is integral to what's happening. And before we get to all of that, I want to share the story of one of the asylum seekers I met at Our Lady of Soledad. This is Gaspar Tadeo, and he's describing his journey with his son out of their small town in Guatemala.
Sí, salimos de nuestro Guatemala fronterizo pagando un dinero.
So he's saying he left the frontera, the small town in Guatemala. He went to Mexicali and took a combination of buses and taxis through Mexico to the border. And when he crossed, he surrendered to Customs and Border Protection. And here, Steve, you may be thinking, okay, that sounds a lot like what we've been hearing for years. But what's new is that normally this would be the end. Tadeo and his son would be processed. Then travel would be arranged for them to get to their family and await a court date if they have a valid reason for a hearing.
A valid reason for a hearing, which is what we've heard about in the past. But that is changing now, Benjamin, because there are so many Central American refugees who are seeking asylum here?
That's exactly right. And let me reintroduce Father Guy Wilson.
Previously, in most situations, they were received and taken care of at the border at detention centers. Now they claim they're overwhelmed, or they don't have enough resources.
So instead, Steve, what's happening? Federal officials are driving buses or vans full of asylum seekers north from either the El Centro or Yuma border crossings, Yuma, Arizona, and then another 90 miles at least into inland desert California towns like Indio or Blythe. But those places that have federal facilities are also too full. They can't hold them. So what happens is they have to go elsewhere. The county of Riverside then gets involved, or sometimes federal officials. They're dropping people off at this church. I spoke with Customs and Border Protection about this. They said they are not releasing any numbers about how many asylum seekers have been through this process. But this has been happening, Father Guy Wilson says, every day since October. And they receive dozens a day. He estimates more than 4,000 so far.
Many of the people who come, the adults have an ankle bracelet. And that's used for prisoners. And so that's to track them. And the reason is because all they have is the immigration custom enforcement. All they have is the address of where they say they're going. And then from that address, they give them a court date where they can come before a judge to talk about their asylum case.
So I just want to clear up one thing. These people are now legally in the U.S. It's not, you hear a lot of rhetoric about people who are coming illegally. These people have a legal reason to be here. They have a court date, and there's an argument that they should be allowed to stay here and that they deserve refugee status.
Well, which is the back and forth between who is exactly an asylum seeker and what kind of validation they have. What do Customs and Border Protection say about this? Do they acknowledge that they're kind of incapable of handling all the migrants coming in?
Yeah, I had a really interesting conversation with Carlos Pintones. He's a CBP officer at the El Centro station, and he confirmed to me that this is true. They're overwhelmed. They can't deal with how many people are crossing the border that are seeking asylum or otherwise. He also confirmed to me that he's been the one that's made calls to Our Lady of Soledad to arrange these drop-offs. Also, he emphasized this is fairly new, that his agency has been at record capacity for the past few months as far as apprehensions along the southwest border. And resource-wise, he says they are finally starting to get what they need, but is the church getting what it needs? That's what I asked Father Guy Wilson.
At first, it felt like we were out here on our own because we were just finding people at the bus stations. But then when we were able to communicate with the Border Patrol especially, they were very good in letting us know how many were coming, when they were coming. That changed, though, at a certain point. We're hoping to reconnect with the Border Patrol and also with ICE to get better communication. It seemed to come when President Trump visited the California border. All of a sudden, we were receiving nobody for about a week. And then we were not receiving reports how many were coming. We just knew they were being dropped off at certain areas. That was his talk when he said, we're full, go back, we're full.
I remember when the president said that, America is full. How long do they stay at that church, Benjamin? What do they do for the people who are there?
What they're doing for folks, Steve, is what you would imagine should be done at the border, at a federal processing facility. So the first thing they do is they feed them. That's a big priority for the church. And by the way, again, this is a church, so there's prayer involved.
Por Cristo nuestro Señor.
Amen.
Muy bien.
So they all eat, and after they eat, there's a big sigh of relief. And actually, something that's really interesting, Steve, is I was watching, and unprompted, all the folks cleaned up after themselves. Mm. They bust the tables. After they eat, Steve, what they do is they go outside, and they come outside to see a bunch of tables set up with clothing on it. Mm. We've got shoes, dresses, shirts, all sorts of things that people would need after a long journey. You can hear right there, I saw there was a teenage girl. She was pressing a dress up to her body and asking the nun if this fits, if it works. And again, all these clothes here are donated from around the country, from the local community, and also through Catholic charities. Here's Father Guy Wilson talking about this. He explains just how mindful the parents are of their children.
We receive mothers who have little infants, and they hold on to them so tight. And the reason is they're fearful that the government's going to take their children from them, because that's what was part of the policy. So they've heard about that policy. So here at least they know that it's safe, and we have other mothers to hold their children so they can bathe and they can eat.
But this isn't permanent where they are at this church,
no,
Our Lady of Soledad. So where do they go from here?
So as to where they're going, it's interesting because you would think, okay, they're in, you know, the desert area of Southern California. They'll probably head north to Los Angeles or other communities in Southern California, Northern California. But no, nearly all of the folks that Father Guy Wilson has seen in the past several months are going to the East Coast. They often take a bus. They pay for their own tickets themselves, or they get donations from Catholic charities. And when I was there, the destinations were Georgia, Florida, and Virginia. And you might be asking why. Well, back in the 80s in Central America, when there was a lot of turmoil there, folks were allowed to be flown. They were actually given asylum and flown to the East Coast. And so those are the relatives of the people now that are fleeing Central America. So that's where they're going. That's where they have someone who lives in this country that's able to take them as they wait for their asylum case to be processed. Let's take a listen to one of those stories.
Yo me llamo Zaira Godinez. Vamos a Atlanta.
In Georgia?
Uh-huh. Allá vamos. En Atlanta,
Georgia. Muy lejos.
Sí, está lejos.
¿Qué quieres hacer en este país después de todo eso?
Pues bueno, ya Dios ya me ha ayudado, me está ayudando para venir aquí, pues voy a hacer provecho de eso porque no está nada fácil.
So she's saying, Steve, she's thankful to God, first of all, that she and her father have actually made it, that they're here. She's 17 years old, and she wants to help him build a home for their family. As for what she wants to do exactly with her life, she's not sure, but again, she's only 17 years old. So that's typical in many ways, except for, you know, what she's been through to get here to the United States.
That's so fascinating, though, Benjamin, because the program that you mentioned that flew people from those Central American countries to the East Coast, now their relatives have to take the journey all the way from Central America through Mexico into California or Arizona, where they then jump on a bus and go east to join the people who have preceded them.
That's right, without all the support that came several decades ago.
Yeah, much more, I guess, arduous journey, as you said. KCRW's Benjamin Gottlieb. By the way, photos of the church and what happens at Our Lady of Soledad online at kcrw.com/greaterLA. And on social media, just check out KCRW's Instagram page.
Go Greyhound and leave the driving to us. Go Greyhound
and leave the driving to us.
Well, thousands of migrants who come into the country every day through the southwest borders have to find a way to get to their families, and that's where buses come in. Greyhound is a company that's certainly seen its share of problems over the years, but now it's reaping the business and the chaos of this huge influx of people needing to get from point A to point B inside the United States. Miriam Jordan is national immigration correspondent for the New York Times, and she reported on this story. Hi, Miriam.
Hi there.
This is a company that almost stopped being an ongoing concern a few times in its past, hasn't it?
Exactly. I mean, Greyhound actually filed for bankruptcy twice in the 90s and has faced increasing competition from the likes of Southwest and other low-cost carriers that have made it a lot more affordable for people to fly. Paired with that is the fact that fuel prices have dropped considerably, and people are incentivized to just get in their cars.
And so a lot of migrants are coming across the border, and they need to get from one place to another in the country. They don't perhaps have the wherewithal to get on an airplane. And you start your piece at the Greyhound station in Dallas, Texas. Can you describe what you saw at that place?
The Greyhound station in Dallas had been converted into a migrant shelter by default. It was something akin to what you'd see after a hurricane when people have been evacuated and gathered in a stadium or an auditorium. It was completely covered with migrant families, children, moms cradling babies, older folks with grandchildren, every one of them having crossed the border in the last few days and been released.
You actually made a trip with a Guatemalan family, these are the Lopez's, all the way from Tucson, Arizona to Nashville, Tennessee. Two parents, three children. What was that experience like?
Well, I connected with this family at a monastery in Phoenix that's run by Catholic Community Services. It's been receiving many of the migrants. So the migrants arrive there, and the families like the Lopez contact their relatives, because most of the migrants do have relatives in the interior of the country, and ask that they purchase their bus tickets for them. Once those tickets are purchased, they have a time and date to travel. Sometimes they have to wait a few days because there are so many migrants trying to get on the Greyhound buses that they can't all be accommodated immediately. So in the case of the Lopez families, they spent 3 days at the shelter, and we boarded the bus on April 5th in the evening. The bus arrived late from Phoenix. There were two broken seats on the bus. It'd been overbooked, so the Lopez family made it onto the bus by the skin of their teeth. Other migrant families in Tucson who had hoped to board the same bus that was bound for Dallas did not make it.
So that goes to show you these challenges that the bus company and the people who are riding the buses are facing with the uptick in business with Greyhound. It's being deluged, essentially.
You know, absolutely. So when we, you know, finally arrived in Dallas, 2 hours and 47 minutes late, we realized, as many other migrants who were already at the station had learned, that we'd missed our connections and were stranded at the Dallas station. We had to wait 2 days and two nights until we could get on a bus to Nashville because every single bus was, you know, completely booked.
Wow.
But they were among the more fortunate families in the sense that, you know, they had a few, you know, they had a few dollars on them. They could walk down the street to the McDonald's and buy, you know, hamburgers and fries. Whereas many of these other families who were stranded there had literally no money and no provisions.
There were a few Americans traveling on those buses, too. One you talked to was a retired truck driver who wasn't at all happy with who was on the bus with him. Can you explain that?
Right. So there was a gentleman named Don Shockley, a retired truck driver who had like 4 million miles under his belt and was sitting in the back of the bus and scanning the rows ahead of him and did remark to me pretty early in the journey that, wow, you know, it's almost like we're the foreigners, you know, we ought to build a wall. It won't keep everybody out, but it'll keep some of them out. But later he showed a lot of humanity, I felt. And when the bus stopped at about 2 a.m. in the morning in El Paso, there was a migrant family whose mother asked me how long it would take to reach Nashville. And when I informed her that we were more than 24 hours away from Nashville, in fact, we still had to get to Dallas, she responded, you know, with resignation to me that, you know, my goodness, I have no more food and no more money. She had been stranded already for two nights at the Phoenix station waiting for a bus. When I shared this with the truck driver, Don Shockley, I could sense that he was processing this, and not even a minute later, he handed me $12 and told me to give the money to the woman. I said he should give the money to her himself, but he didn't speak Spanish, and he said, you know, give her the money. A lot of people have been good to me when I've been on the road.
You and the Lopez family made it to Nashville, finally. Who was meeting those folks there?
The Lopez family was meeting a relative who's a longtime resident of the United States, as is typical with this wave of migrants. Almost all of them who I encounter already have family or friends in the United States who will receive them and help them settle in. So they were met by a relative in the Nashville area who had committed to housing them and taking care of them as long as they can remain in the United States, which is an open question.
It sounds like a harrowing tale, and it happens, plays out every day at bus stations across the country, particularly bus stations in the American Southwest, but also in other places as well. Miriam Jordan, National Immigration Correspondent for The New York Times. Miriam, thanks for sharing the story.
Absolutely. Have a good day. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Back with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Well, everyone agrees there is a need for more, much more, affordable housing. And California Democrats, with a raft of bills and a supermajority in Sacramento, seemed poised to make something happen this year. So then why does Alyssa Walker from Curbed LA write that the month of May, quote, might very well go down as the worst month in California's housing policy history? Well, let's ask her. Alyssa's here right now. Hi.
Hi, Steve.
So?
It was bad.
It was bad? the worst in California's housing policy history?
At least in recent memory, I think. So go back to November after the elections, right? And every race that was being called for Democrats. So we knew there was going to be this supermajority in the state legislature, which is a big deal for people who want to get things done, because you would think that if you have a supermajority, the people would be in agreement and you could very easily get bills passed, right? So what happened is a bunch of these bills were passed, everything from increasing production of housing to making sure that people could stay in their homes, a bunch of rental protection, tenant protection bills. And so many of them, just as the month wore on, started to fail, including some really big ones that would have really changed the state.
Like Senate Bill 50.
This was the big one that got all the attention, right? So this was the one that would have increased building heights, density for residential developments around what they call high quality transit. So these are bus lines and train lines that have a lot of people using them, which is where we want to put more housing so people aren't driving around.
So what are some of the, besides SB 50, what are some of the other bills that got shelved or killed?
Well, I think one of the most transformative one that actually probably would have been more palatable for some of the single family homeowners who were so against SB 50. They don't want tall buildings on their street. They don't want denser development necessarily, is a bill that kind of got merged into SB 50 as part of this whole negotiations process. And this was SB 4, which was named because it basically would have taken all single family zoning across the state and said you could build a fourplex where a single family home would be. And that creates that kind of like gentle density that maybe your whole life wouldn't be upended by just having a single family home carved up into four units.
Did you just coin a new term, though? Gentle density?
Yes. Well, I think that's the big concern, right? And if you want to add more people, especially to these areas that are very wealthy, that have a lot of amenities, that are close to jobs, and that are close to transit. I took the Expo Line train here, and you go through all these neighborhoods where there are just single family homes right off of either side of the Expo Line stations. That we need to allow more people to live near the Expo Line so they can go to work and they can go to other places without having to get into their car.
I know there's a lot of criticism pointed at Los Angeles Mayor Eric Garcetti. We've got a homeless, and a lot of people call it a crisis. It is a crisis because there are so many people. It's ticked up now to just under 60,000 in L.A. County, the county as a whole. But the mayor has been taking a lot of heat because a lot of and a lot of politicians, for that matter, local politicians, whom folks in this town don't really believe are doing the job that they should be doing on this issue.
I think that is valid criticism only because our city council members voted unanimously against SB 50 by saying that we have our own programs in place to add density and add affordable housing and build more. But they're not dramatic enough and they're not happening fast enough to ensure that this housing can be produced.
What about all these measures that voters passed a couple of years ago? And I'm thinking L.A. County and L.A. City voters. These were propositions or measures H and Triple H and all of that. Talking about the homeless issue, the crisis in this area. What about those funds? We're talking millions and tens and hundreds of millions of dollars coming into the city and county.
Yes, these are a huge inflow of money. And I think everyone who worked on the homeless numbers this year said we house more people than ever. We housed over 20,000 people. We were able to get people off the streets. But what happens is we did not have enough countermeasures to make sure that people aren't being evicted, you know, for no reason, or that rent hikes aren't going to suddenly make somebody not be able to pay their rent next month and have to move out. So we need to follow that up with a big, strong batch of tenant protections, which was going to come from the state. And we all kind of thought that the state was going to pass these bills and make sure that the relief could start tomorrow. Housing takes a long time to build. And HHH is a great example. We voted for this thing on the same day Trump was elected, if you can remember back that long ago. It was it seems like it's been decades. But that was 1,000 days until the first unit opened for people to move into. It took 1,000 days to get that approved, built, and move families into that.
3 years.
Three years. I mean, it's a really long time.
And there are other things coming forward. Like, all right, if May was such a bad housing policy month for California, do we have something, say, to look forward to? Are there other things happening in the pipeline that maybe there gives us some hope?
There are some good things. I would say the big bright spot that everybody is looking at right now is ADU bills, accessory dwelling unit, or you might call it a granny shack.
A
lot of people like.
This is your garage in the backyard.
This is basically your garage that you won't need anymore because you're going to take transit and ride your bike everywhere. So a lot of people might not need those. And what's great too about ADUs is they're relaxing a lot of the parking restrictions around those too. So one of the things that makes housing so expensive in LA is that you have to add one and sometimes two parking spots. And if we can relax the parking restrictions, then that means we're not having having to take away space that could be used for, you know, housing people instead of cars, but also making sure that homeowners who want to add these to the back of their properties can not have to spend extra money to build garages next to their garages, their repurposed garages. The other thing is that there's two programs at the county and city level that will help homeowners with a little bit of the financing and a little bit of the permitting process if they agree to house someone who was formerly homeless. And that's a great idea. But again, how fast can we get these up? How fast can we make sure that these units are being built?
All right. Alyssa Walker, urbanism editor at Curbed and a contributor here at Greater LA. Alyssa, thanks.
Thank you, Steve.
That's our show for today. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Let's do it again tomorrow.